From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
It's a one-party state where the Communist Party has a guaranteed monopoly of political power and no one elects its leaders. This is pretty rare now among the major countries, but we still have it in China.
China's a dinosaur. It's a Marxist state that acts like an 18th century colonial empire. But China's changing. This hour, we're examining China today, from politics and diplomacy to the magical sounds of the pipa. And we'll take a look at the history of the Chinese in America.
America was for white people only, and that there was something almost strange and machine-like about the Chinese, and they just didn't deserve to be here.
Also this hour, a conversation with three Chinese writers in exile. We'll talk with Nobel laureate Gao Xingqin and National Book Award winner Ha Jin and up-and-coming novelist Annie Wang.
I believe best literature will be born among the overseas Chinese writers, not the Chinese writers inside China.
But first, what does the future hold for U.S.-China relations? When the Soviet Union fell, many thought China was poised to be the next evil empire. So is it? Ross Terrell is an expert on U.S.-China relations. He's just written a book called The New Chinese Empire and What It Means for the United States. Terrell says diplomacy between the People's Republic of China and the U.S. was greatly affected by the events of September 11th.
They improved them because President Bush has been scraping up allies in the war against terror wherever he can find them. And Beijing had a good reason to sign on. Their reason isn't exactly the same as ours. I think for most Americans, the war on terror is about defending freedom against the supreme unaccountability of a terrorist organization. For China, it's a question of the unity of China, because they've got a lot of non-Chinese peoples in the western half of the country, and in particular, they've got Muslims in the West who have links outside of China, and the U.S. agreed to name some of the Muslims in exile from Xinjiang, this western part of China, as a terrorist organization, which arguably they are. I mean, some of the Uyghurs, as they're called, use violent methods, others don't. So there we are. We have an FBI office in Beijing today, and the fact that to some extent we're at cross purposes, well, we're at cross purposes with Pakistan too. I mean, any dictatorship is arguably a poor candidate for the war on terror, but there it is. We're not in a perfect world.
But it is true, isn't it, that we're ignoring the lack of democracy in China at the same time that we're extolling the virtues of democracy everywhere else in the world?
Well, you're absolutely right. Most Americans go to the China coast. But China, the PRC, is really a rough equivalent to the whole of Europe, both in size, in diversity of culture, and even of language. It has borders with 14 countries, leaving aside some additional ones where the foreign country is just a couple of hundred miles across the water. It abuts Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, Central Asia, and South Asia. A very unenviable environment. We have no idea what it's like to govern China because we've got a huge ocean east and west, and we've got a benign neighbor in the north and a benign neighbor in the south. It's quite different in China, and China's not had any other traditional way of holding the place together except autocracy. And it's my argument in the book that partly for inherent reasons of governance, partly because the Communist Party skillfully grafted Leninism onto elements of an imperial tradition, that it remains an autocratic show. And yes, we exempt China from our clarion calls for democracy.
How should we view this enormous country? I mean, is it possible We tend to talk of China as though it were one thing, and the China you've just described is only superficially one thing. It's a country that includes 100 different peoples and an awful lot of ideas that are boiling under the control of the state.
China is a bit of a dinosaur to still have a Leninist system, or what I call an imperial system, a system from above where the state is the fount of truth as well as of power, and where the non-Chinese peoples are not called by hyphenated titles. You can't be a Korean Chinese or a Tibetan Chinese in China. You are part of the Korean national minority or the Tibetan national minority. What does that mean? You're a building block. You're part of a collective building block in an imperium.
But at the same time, if you are a part of the collective building block, if you are a collective building block, then you are, by definition, not fully Chinese and therefore perhaps not as good as the Chinese themselves?
Well, the Tibetans think that, but the Chinese position is that everyone is destined to be a citizen of China. And in practice, this means that a Han-led political culture is emerging. I've got a section in the book where I discuss various scenarios for how Beijing will relate to the peripheral areas. One of them is that they'll pull it off. They will homogenize Inner Mongolia and the rest by sending so many Han people there and having sufficient economic success that people will wake up 30 years from now and say, well, I'm not really just a Mongolian, I'm part Chinese, and the problem will be solved. That's Beijing's hope. Other possibility is that economic development will actually add to the sense of identity of the Uyghurs, the Muslims in Xinjiang, the Tibetans, and that they will be less accommodating to Beijing's straitjacket of Chineseness when they prosper than they were before.
How much can we look to the experience of the fall of the Soviet Union in trying to anticipate the future for the Chinese empire?
The Chinese Communist Party is not as much a failure as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was by the mid-80s. The Communist Party of China has made a tacit pact with the people. You get rich and you let us run the place with an iron hand. And if economic growth continues, that pact may continue. The second big difference with the Soviet Union is that the Soviet Union was only half Russian. The rest were other ethnicities. China's 90% Han. And though the non-Han, the non-Chinese, occupy a large amount of Western and Northern territory, that is a big difference to the potentiality for uprising. The Soviet Union came apart when Gorbachev loosened at the center, and then the non-Russian peoples, the Estonians, the Latvians, the Ukrainians, took advantage of the situation, and suddenly the Soviet Union looked like an empire. Well, it had always been an empire. But if that happens in the Chinese case, there's far smaller percentage of people who are non-Chinese who'll be standing up and saying, we want to be a separate nation.
There's also the question that you raise of the economic future of China, because at the moment it's in a state of transition. It's been a communist-controlled state and remains that. But there is a transition to a capitalist economic system. Is it possible for those two to coexist? Is there a future, a solid future for China with those two working together or in conflict?
I don't believe so. I think to travel down one road in economics, commercialization, or arguably, as you say, capitalism, and another road in politics, a system from above where no one's elected, doesn't make for a clear destination or a very comfortable journey. Now, there are two views here. The Communist Party thinks that they're streamlining the system by becoming prosperous. And they think the commercialization of China will not interfere with the ongoing authoritarianism of the system. What do I mean by authoritarianism? It's a one-party state where the Communist Party has a guaranteed monopoly of political power and no one elects its leaders. This is pretty rare now among the major countries, but we still have it in China. The other view, Jim, is that what happens in society and the economy will ultimately produce a new politics, that you can't separate economic freedom and political freedom indefinitely.
In the light of Chinese history, and Chinese history goes back for thousands of years, is the new Chinese empire that you talk about now significantly different?
China as a civilization is indubitably great, but they have had a lot of trouble with the political system. And sometimes their solution to this is just smoke and mirrors. You have a gap between theory and practice. For example, in the dynastic period, the emperor was called the Son of Heaven. His realm was called All Under Heaven. So in theory, there was no differentiation between Chinese civilization and world civilization. There were no boundaries. Now, in fact, reality was different. But this rather delightful conceit, it sustained the Chinese. So this gap between theory and practice has served the Chinese very well. And now, of course, the gap is updated. This is supposed to be a Marxist-Leninist state, but as you said, it's shed many of the aspects of a Marxist-Leninist economy, and it allows people to be non-socialist as long as they're not anti-socialist. There's no connection here between the public philosophy of China and this new individualism. It's if the people on a different planet. The individuals in the cities are not so much against the Communist Party, they just think the Communist Party is somewhat irrelevant.
Ross Terrell is the author of the book The New Chinese Empire and What It Means for the United States. Just ahead, we'll talk with the world-renowned Chinese traditional musician Wu Man about the synergy between Western and Eastern music.
When I first time played in concert hall in West, in New York, and some musician came up to me say, "Wow, you're like Jimi Hendrix." And, you know, I had no idea who is Jimi Hendrix.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. For many of us in the West, Chinese is an alien, almost impenetrable culture. It has a difficult language, complicated customs. But one way to bridge that gap is through music. And if you want to understand Chinese music, a good place to start is with a pipa. The pipa is a pear-shaped musical instrument made out of wood. Looks something like a guitar, maybe a lute, but it has four strings and is plucked with the fingers. If you really want to understand what the pipa is, you have to listen to it. I asked pipa virtuoso Wu Man to play a piece for me in the studio. Thank you. It's really quite beautiful, and it sounds as though there are similarities to Western instruments, but there's no question, listening to it as an American, that that is a Chinese sound.
Yeah.
Is it a popular instrument in China?
I would say it is very popular of the traditional instrument.
But not an easy thing to play.
Well, yes, that's true. The beginning, the starting lot, very, very difficult. You hear the tremolo, that use a five fingering to pluck, and very fast. That's take you a lot of time to practice.
Is there a particular style of pipa that you learn to play?
Yeah, there are quite a number of the playing style. I started with one style with a master. It's called Pudong School. Mm-hmm. The Pudong is the area in Shanghai area. So that's the style I'm playing.
Are there traditional compositions for the pipa?
There are a lot of traditional, we call classical piece. Yeah, mm-hmm. A lot.
But I suppose in our system, we wouldn't know the difference particularly between a folk tune mm-hmm. and a classical Chinese tune. They might sound as though they were both primarily Chinese, I guess.
Yeah, for the Western ear, probably that's true. Cannot tell what's the classical or folk is different. But the pipa is way back, around 2,000 years old. Actually was introduced from Central Asia, from a Persian area.
Would you be able to play for me two different styles so I might get a chance to try to distinguish them?
Yeah, the two different style is what we call martial style and lyrical style. Mm-hmm. That's the two main pipa classical style.
Could you play just a little of the martial style first for us?
Okay.
And the lyrical style, I assume, is quieter, more contemplative?
Very quiet. Describe moon, river, flower.
Could you play moon for me? Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
You were clearly, you're an accomplished player. You were clearly on the fast track in China. Why did you come to the United States?
During the 80s, Chinese government opened the door to the West. And during that time, we have opportunity to see outside the world. And especially for my generation, we were all students. And in music school, in music conservatory, we have a lot of Western musicians visit us, giving us master class, like Isaac Stern, Amit Yuen, and all the masters, conductor Seiji Ozawa. It was really, really stimulated to us. All my friends, they play piano, or violin, or composers. They went out. I was like, wait a minute, what about me?
You wanted to go too?
Yeah, they said, bye, I'm leaving, I'm to Europe, I'm to America. I said, what are you guys doing then? They said, we went to study, and that's why I came. I followed them.
It's complicated for you though, isn't it? I mean, they were studying piano, violin. Those are instruments where there is an established career path in mm-hmm. the Western world. Mm-hmm. The pipa certainly has not had as many clear opportunities for
right.
you.
Right.
Has it been difficult for you to move in the world of Western music?
Very, very difficult. When I arrived here in 1990, I didn't speak English. I brought several instruments with me, three pipas and other traditional plucking instruments, just in case. And also because I didn't speak English, so I didn't have friends. It's really hard. You know, I didn't watch TV. I didn't read the newspaper. And I didn't know what to do. And people, of course, didn't know what is pipa, what is Chinese music.
You must have felt very isolated.
Yeah, very, very depressing. And when I started learning English and starting speaking, open my mouth and talk to people, and I played small concerts in New York, Chinatown area, or during Chinese New Year, and for mostly for Chinese community. And started there, people recognized, oh, there's a pipa player.
I was listening to, it's an Access World CD. There's a piece on it called Dancing that sounds like bluegrass to me.
I love bluegrass.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
But in this case, it sounds like pipa bluegrass.
That's right. That's exactly what I want. I can't compare with bluegrass, but yeah, that's the idea.
It's a curious thing, I guess, to me, because you think of traditional instruments, of players of traditional instruments, as being rooted in the tradition and often unwilling to vary from that, to accept others. You don't seem to have any worry about the place of the pipa, the prominent place of the pipa in any tradition.
It's just a fascinating opportunity to me when I moved here, moved to States. You know, my mouth just suddenly opened like, wow! When I was in New York, you know, downtown, a lot of club, different, just so many different kind of music, experimental music, theater. Just being a musician, I just couldn't stop. I just want to do it. I want to try it. That's probably why.
I think somebody told me that you've even electrified your pipa on occasion.
Yeah. That's my another experiment.
When you electrify your instrument, it doesn't even sound like a pipa anymore. I mean, does it to you?
No. That's what I want. I use the guitar pedals, wah-wah pedal. This is inspired by Jimi Hendrix. There's a story there. When I first time I played in concert hall in West, in New York, and some musician came up to me say, wow, you're like Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, I had no idea who is Jimi Hendrix. So now I listen to a lot of his music and inspired him. That's why I want to play wah-wah pipa or electronic pipa.
Wu Man's new CD is called Pipa From a Distance. Wu Man can also be heard in the music of Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road project. If you'd like to hear more of Wu Man playing pipa live in the studio, click on our website at www.ttbook.org. It's a precarious life being a serious writer in China. Authors brave enough to tackle controversial subjects often face censorship or even arrest. And their predicament was even worse during the Cultural Revolution. Some of the leading Chinese writers now live in exile. Steve Paulson talked with three of them. Nobel laureate Gao Xingqian, his best-known novel is called Soul Mountain. Ha Jin, he won the National Book Award for his novel Waiting. And Annie Wong, who is the youngest of the bunch. Her book's a coming-of-age story called Lily. Steve says each of these writers had to struggle through hard times.
3 years ago, Gaoxing Chen became the first Chinese writer to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. You might think this would be cause for celebration in China. Instead, government officials blasted him as a mediocre talent, and many writers and academics in China denounced him, even though they hadn't actually read his work. Which is not surprising. His books and plays are banned in China. Gaoxing Chen's run-ins with the authorities date back to 1983, when his play Bus Stop was called the most pernicious play since the creation of the People's Republic. Gao realized he'd better be careful, so when communist officials were cracking down on writers and intellectuals, he burned all his plays and novellas.
There were lots of others doing the same thing. Otherwise, they'd be accused of political crimes. All of his works he wrote without any thought of it ever being published, and they would have been particularly dangerous. So at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, he burnt several kilo of his writings.
This must have been heartbreaking for a writer, for an artist. I mean, this is what defines a life.
At the time, he was too frightened to even think of being heartbroken by doing this. There was just no time to feel regret or pity. He had to save himself.
Facing possible arrest, Gaoxing Chen went underground, and for 5 months he trekked across China, traveling some 10,000 miles, searching for remnants of traditional Chinese culture. What he saw and heard became the material for his acclaimed novel, Soul Mountain. It's a fantastic tale of famous bandits, a great Taoist master, mythical wild men who stalk the ancient forests, vamps who devour their lovers. You might say the government's crackdown forced his hand as a writer. Soul Mountain became a metaphor for the loss of faith in everything around him.
It's not about a specific place, it's about a process of searching, about doubting everything, doubting history, doubting culture, even doubting whether language can express all these thoughts.
Forced to leave China, Gaoxing Chen lived in exile in Paris and eventually became a French citizen. Ironically, he made his name there not as a writer, but as a painter. But winning the Nobel Prize in Literature is likely to change all that. Ha Jin is another celebrated Chinese writer in exile, with his own story of surviving the Cultural Revolution. He joined the army when he was 14 years old.
We went to school, but we only copied slogans. There was nothing to study in school, so I went to the army. It was a better choice by comparison, because many, many youngsters were sent to the countryside working in the fields, so the army was a much better choice.
Ha Jin taught himself to read and write during his 5 years in the army. When China's colleges reopened, he studied American literature and eventually came to the U.S. to work on a Ph.D. Today, he's famous for the elegant prose of his award-winning novel, Waiting. But when he first moved to Boston, Ha Jin was fired as a waiter because his English was so bad.
For me, the most difficult part in the job is the menu. I couldn't remember the menu and the wine list. They were not in the dictionary. Then I got other jobs, like a janitor in a hospital. It was a much better job.
But I'm trying to figure out how you could go, and I mean, the time span is not that long. We're talking probably less than 15 years when you were not allowed to be a waiter in a steakhouse to winning the National Book Award for a novel written in English. It's remarkable.
But your life is put on the line. You have to survive.
Ha Jin planned to return to China, where he had a good job as a translator, but the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre changed all that.
I couldn't, just couldn't, and I don't want to serve a government like that, so brutal to its own citizens. I just couldn't do it.
What happened in Tiananmen Square had a profound impact on another up-and-coming writer. In 1989, Annie Wong was a 16-year-old living in Beijing. She was a model student. In fact, she'd hosted a radio show and was even voted the outstanding student in all of China. But her life changed when she started to hang out with students and intellectuals in Tiananmen Square. The massacre itself is seared into her memory.
The next day, I saw a food stand where I used to buy breakfast every day. And I saw this blood stain on the food stand. And I was told that the old man who was selling breakfast to me every day was killed. So the sky was gray. I remember that just it started to rain after the night of massacre. Those images are still very vivid. They stay with me. I think they will stay with me forever.
What's striking about these three writers in exile, Annie Wong, Ha Jin, and Gao Xing Qin, is how they all stumbled into politics. Not much of their writing is explicitly political, but what seems to rile up the Chinese censors isn't just criticism of communism, but also more basic questions about individual freedom. Ha Jin's novel Waiting is based on a true story. It's about a man who had an arranged marriage. He's sent off to a distant town to work as an army doctor. He falls in love with a nurse there, but he's not allowed to divorce for 18 years. Ha Jin says this draconian rule was not national policy. It was simply decreed by the man who ran the hospital.
People internalized the rule as part of their daily existence. Nobody would challenge it.
Now, what comes through in your story is how many rules there are governing personal life.
Yes.
For instance, Lin, the doctor, falls in love with this other woman, this young nurse at the hospital. They have to wait all these years before they can be together. There are rules that they cannot even go out of the compound together.
In order to prevent unlawful relationships between men and women.
Gao Xing Qin knows all too well the need for a zone of privacy. In his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, he said, "Talking to yourself is the starting point of literature." It's a comment that would hardly raise an eyebrow in America, but talking to oneself is a radical statement for a Chinese writer.
This is the most basic critical thing in literature in China during the Cultural Revolution in particular. When all literature was to be used as a political tool, this was indeed so. So it was important that literature had this ability to be addressing oneself.
One dilemma for exiled writers is figuring out which language to write in. Once Ha Jin had settled in America, he realized he had to learn how to write literature in English.
I had to think in English. Otherwise, the feel, the sensibility, everything would be different.
Critics have pointed out that Ha Jin's novel Waiting is a throwback to the kind of 19th century novel that Henry James might have written, not at all the postmodern fiction you see so much of today. Ha Jin says that's partly because he brings a Chinese sensibility to his writing in English.
I think my writing very often more earthy and closer to things. This is somehow, I think, affected by the Chinese language, which is words are closer to things.
Closer to the material
world.
Yeah,
to the material things, yeah. By contrast, the English language is more eloquent, more speculative.
Annie Wong's love of English goes back to a traumatic episode in the third grade. She kept a diary where she wrote about a crush she had on a boy. A friend stole the diary and read it out loud. Annie was humiliated, and from then on, she reserved her most private thoughts for English words, which she looked up in the dictionary. Wong later wrote her novel Lily in English, which allowed her to explore taboo subjects like female sexuality.
So my early association of English was this language of romance, intimacy, and secrecy. So when I started to write Lily, I couldn't write it in Chinese because people know that there are things that you are not supposed to say or you are not supposed to talk about.
But if writers in China are censoring themselves, it raises an important question. Can you be a serious writer there, or do you need to leave? Annie Wong has a sobering conclusion.
I believe best literature will be born among the overseas Chinese writers, not the Chinese writers inside China.
Annie Wong is the author of the novel Lily. Ha Jin won the National Book Award for his novel Waiting. Gao Xing Qin won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2000. Steve Paulson spoke with them. Later this hour, a late-night call-in radio show that changed China and what it means to be Chinese in America.
If the Chinese Americans are model minorities, then perhaps other minorities, such as Hispanics, are not model minorities. And people believe that perhaps there's almost a kind of a divide-and-conquer strategy that is being used, where the achievements of one ethnic group would be used to punish another.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The history of Chinese immigration in America is an epic tale spanning more than 150 years. It's a story of building a railroad and of Charlie Chan. It's a story of extreme racism and segregation. It's also a story of Chinatown and scientific advances. Iris Chang has taken on the daunting task of telling this history in a book called The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. Chang told Steve Paulson that the Chinese often became the scapegoats for America's economic woes.
During the economic depression of the 1870s, the Chinese found themselves vilified in the media and also subject to a lot of racist state legislation because white workers that found it hard to compete with the Chinese economically. And so they organized to try to marginalize them or even to drive them out of the country. And this eventually led to the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was passed by Congress in 1882. And it prevented the Chinese from coming to this country, at least, you know, the laborers, for the next few decades.
And the Chinese Exclusion Act is kind of this remarkable period in American history and in immigration history to actually prevent one particular ethnic group from entering the United States.
There's no question of it. And it had devastating consequences for the Chinese population. They lost nearly a century of political mobilization as a result of that. While other ethnic groups were coming to this country, the Chinese could not emigrate in large numbers. Essentially, only certain classes of Chinese could come, such as Chinese merchants or scholars or diplomats, but these were very small numbers. The Chinese laborers were barred completely.
How was the Chinese Exclusion Act justified by U.S. government officials?
They never really did make a very convincing argument, but the arguments that were put forth by congressmen was that America was for white people only, and that there was something almost strange and machine-like about the Chinese, and they just didn't deserve to be here. In addition to all of this legislation, we also saw Chinese people being attacked in the streets and lynched. There was a period called the driving out era in Chinese American history, which started with that depression and also continued through the 1880s. And in small towns and cities across the American West, they would be often rounded up and forced out of their homes or even massacred.
Now, it seems that the second big wave of Chinese immigration into America was very different.
Absolutely.
Really coming after the communist takeover of China in 1949, I mean, many of those families who ended up settling in America moved fairly quickly into middle class, even upper middle class neighborhoods, largely white neighborhoods.
By that time, many of the anti-Chinese laws had been struck from the books. And by the time the second wave came, the social climate had also changed. All throughout World War II, the Chinese people, and by extension the Chinese Americans, were seen as really the good guys during the Sino-American wartime alliance, while the Japanese and the Japanese Americans were seen as the bad guys. And therefore, the exclusion laws were repealed, and laws that prevented them from moving into white neighborhoods also eventually were taken off the books.
Where did the whole notion of the model minority come from? That this idea that, particularly in colleges and universities, that Asian Americans, Chinese Americans among them, were exceptional students?
Well, the term started to surface in the media in the 1980s when Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans started entering our colleges and universities in large numbers, often, you know, winning national merit scholarships and Westinghouse competitions. And there was a perception out there that the Chinese really were minorities that would be held up as a model for all others. Now, this term, model minority, has often proved very controversial, especially within the Asian American community. Some people have found the image to be somewhat divisive. They feel that if the Chinese Americans are model minorities, then perhaps other minorities, such as Hispanics, are not model minorities. And people believe that perhaps there's almost a kind of a divide and conquer strategy that is being used, where the achievements of one ethnic group would be used to punish another.
Now, when I was growing up, and I'm guessing that my experience was not that different from a lot of other white kids, the one image that you saw of the Chinese in the popular media were the Charlie Chan movies.
Yes.
Is that just an embarrassment, I mean, to think back on those?
Well, I think the Chinese American community has mixed feelings about the Charlie Chan images, because on one hand, I think some people would even consider them to be relatively positive images compared to the Fu Manchu stereotypes, because, you know, Charlie Chan would solve the mysteries. But then on the other hand, it did perpetuate this image of the Chinese as being kind of these inscrutable people with fortune cookie Confucian wisdom. And what's really needed today are images that show Chinese Americans as the hardworking U.S. citizens that many of them are, with normal problems like everyone else, trying to make a living and rear their children. And we don't have these kinds of images in Hollywood to the degree that we need them.
Iris Chang is the author of the book The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. She spoke with Steve Paulson.
Hello, 在这如诉如歌的音乐声中,
You're listening to the beginning of one of the most famous radio shows in China. It was called Words on the Night Breeze, and it was a late-night women's call-in program. It aired for 8 years on China's state radio. The host was a remarkable woman who went by her first name only, Xin Ran. She lives in the West now, and she's just published a collection of the stories told to her on the air. The book's called The Good Women of China, Hidden Voices. Anne Strangchamps has more.
Xin Ran is a small woman with delicate features and a will of steel. She has a beautiful voice, melodic, warm, caring. 5 nights a week for 8 years, Xin Ran's voice gave listeners an unflinching view of what it means to be a woman in modern China. On her radio show, women spoke for the first time about forced marriages, systematic rapes, families torn apart by the Cultural Revolution. Women called her when they were on the verge of suicide. They mailed her their secret diaries. They told her things they'd never told anyone else. Neither Xin Ran nor her bosses had any idea of what kind of floodgates would open when she began her show. Xin Ran says she still remembers the letter that first woke her up from a young boy who lived in a rural village.
I thought I knew Chinese women's life because I'm Chinese woman and my mother Chinese woman, you know. I'm growing up in the Chinese woman's life. So when I read lots of the letters, I feel just a little bit lost until I read this boy's letter. I found something quite seriously because the boy said to me,
"Most respected Xin Ran, I listen to every one of your programs. In fact, everyone in our village likes listening to them. But I'm not writing to tell you how good your program is. I'm writing to tell you a secret. It's not really a secret, because everyone in the village knows. There's an old crippled man of 60 here who recently bought a young wife. The girl looks very young. I think she must have been kidnapped. This happens a lot around here, but many of the girls escape later. The old man is afraid his wife will run off, so he has tied a thick iron chain around her. Her waist has been rubbed raw by the heavy chain. The blood has seeped through her clothes. I think it will kill her. Your loyal listener, Shang Xiaoxuan."
This was the first letter that asked for Xin Ran's personal help, and she wasn't sure what to do. She called the local police, but the officer she spoke to told her that this kind of thing happened a lot, and there wasn't much they could do.
"I said, this girl is going to die. Can you face it? If you say no, I will broadcast your answer. So he said, okay, come to my office. So I went to his office. In fact, we had a deal, and he was very good policeman. Then he helped me went to the little village and save this girl. This girl was only 12 years old. Oh, I was very shocked.
By saving a 12-year-old girl's life, Jinran was breaking an unspoken code of silence. Obedience to men has been a way of life for Chinese women for centuries. In big cities like Shanghai and Beijing, that's changing now, but not in the rural villages. And even in the cities, old attitudes die hard. Jinran's colleagues told her that she'd gone to a lot of trouble for nothing.
Afterwards, lots of people criticized me, say, Jinran, you spend lots of money and energy for this young girl. It's not worth to do it. So I asked them, this is a woman's life. This is a human life. Not just for the material things, it's worth to do or not. So this waked me up a little bit.
Jinran's readiness to speak out and even act on women's behalf earned her the trust of her female listeners. Soon she was getting 100 letters a day, a lot of them asking for basic information about sexuality. A married couple wanted to know how babies were made. A 22-year-old girl worried that she'd get pregnant from holding her boyfriend's hand. Jinran says this kind of ignorance is common in China because for years, talking about sexual matters was strictly forbidden. An unmarried man and woman could be imprisoned or kicked out of their village just for kissing. Because they're raised in such a climate of extreme sexual repression, Jinran says two things happen. Chinese women are hungry for tenderness, for basic human touch, and on the other hand, sexual abuse flourishes. Jinran tells the story of the girl who kept a fly as a pet.
This girl was abused by her father, and she went to ask for help from her mother. But her mother said, be silent about this, otherwise you will destroy this family and also people won't give you any space to live in this world. So this girl couldn't get any way to avoid her father's abuse. So she tried to injure or to hurt herself so that she could be in the hospital.
This girl, whose name was Hong Xu, tried starving herself, soaking herself in cold water and going out in the snow, even breaking her own bones. Even then, she wrote in her diary, her father would come to her room in the hospital and abuse her. Finally, Hong Xu became permanently ill. She wrote in her diary, I long for a real family, where I can be a child and cry in my parents' arms, where I can sleep safely in my bed at home, where loving hands will stroke my head to comfort me after a bad dream. From my earliest childhood, I have never felt this love, and I will never have it now. A few days later, Hong Xu found a baby fly.
One day she was in the hospital, and she felt some touchings very beautiful, and she discovered that was a fly. She never thought this kind of touching so beautiful. So afterwards, she tried to keep a little fly as her pet.
11 May. Sunny. My baby fly is wonderful. I've made a house for it where it can be safe and move around, too. It's a gauze cover, the sort the canteen uses to cover the food. The head cook gave it to me. Nobody would suspect that there was a fly inside an anti-fly cover. Also, I don't have to run to the canteen to get food for it. It can enjoy my rice and vegetables with me. I can sleep in peace again.
Shortly after that diary entry, Hong Xu's doctors told her she was getting better and would be able to go home soon. Panicked, Hong Xu rubbed a dead fly into an infected cut on her arm, hoping it would make her sicker. She died of septicemia 3 weeks later. Reading the stories of these anonymous women is a humbling experience. As novelist Amy Tan writes, their lives are so moving that when I finished reading, I felt my soul had been altered. For 8 years, Jinran heard stories like these every night. In the end, she couldn't take it anymore.
I was told by my doctor in February, he said, Jinran, you must stop taking sleeping pill. By that time, I took almost 8 sleeping pill for one night. So he said, you are kidding yourself, you must stop it. But in the night, especially after program, I just couldn't sleep. So In the night, I always wake up by the bad dreams about my childhood, about some stories like the little girl, you know, kept a fly as her pet. She always come to my dreams and talk with me. Sometimes I just beg her, please don't come back to me.
It was Shinran's boss and mentor who told her she had to write these stories down. If you don't, he said, your heart will be filled up and broken by them. But at that time in China, Shinran would have gone to prison for writing a book like this. So she moved to England. And once there, she began to write, putting into words and onto paper the heart of China.
I just want to let people know, when you notice someone, especially girl or woman, in tears next to you, hug her, ask her, are you okay? Can I help you? You know, in China, we needed this. Most Chinese women, we really need this kind of energy. And this is why last year, there was a report from United Nations. Chinese women's suicide is top of the world. So I just want to, I don't know. All I want to give them is kiss and a hug.
Shinran has put her kiss and a hug into a book. It's called The Good Women of China, Hidden Voices. Shinran spoke with Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for China Today, program number 76A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.